Hello and welcome to this fourth installment of the BSH Lymphoma SIG podcast. My name is Shivir Musai and I'm a hematology registrar working in Birmingham. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Sridhar Chaganti about PTLD. Dr. Chaganti is a consultant hematologist working at University Hospitals Birmingham. He has a special interest in lymphoma and stem cell transplantation. Welcome, Sridhar.
Thank you, Shivir. Pleasure.
So today we'll focus on a couple of cases of PTLD, and we'll talk about the diagnostic workup and then the management. But first, Sridhar, would you like to give an introduction to PTLD?
So just briefly, you know, these are lymphoproliferative diseases that arise in the immunocompromised patient. So they broadly fall into the group of immune deficiency associated lymphoproliferative disease. And PTLD is a specific subtype, if you like, because the immune deficiency in this case is iatrogenic. It is related to a solid organ or stem cell transplant that the patient has received. And most of these patients will be on immune suppression, either transiently in the context of stem cell transplant or lifelong in the context of solid organ transplant. So these patients have an increased risk of developing lymphoproliferative disorders because of the immune deficiency. And as you know, the spectrum can be quite wide-ranging of these lymphoproliferative disorders. At the, I guess, the more polyclonal or polymorphic end, you have early lesions, for example, you know, like plasmacytic hyperplasia or immune infectious mononucleosis type PTLDs, which are truly polyclonal. And these do not really need specific therapy beyond reduction of immune suppression or at the most rituximab generally. But then by the time you go into the more destructive lesions, as they are called in the WHO classification, so these are now tumors. So they may be polymorphic or they may be monomorphic. Important to remember that even polymorphic PTLD can be a malignant condition, even though it looks polymorphic on histology. So it is, by the time you have destructive lesions, they will need more specific therapy usually. And I guess most of the discussion we'll be having today is in the context of the so-called destructive lesions. So it will apply to polymorphic PTLD or the monoclonal lymphomas. Majority of them are B cells. There are unusual T cell or Hodgkin type, which are much rarer and much more challenging because there is no, I guess, standard of care. So I suspect a lot of the times you'll be dealing with B cell PTLD, and which is what we'll be discussing today.
Yeah, you're right. Most of the cases will be focused mainly around B-cell lymphomas. So thanks for that introduction. I'll get cracking with the first case. So a 41-year-old female with renal failure underwent a cadaveric kidney transplant 8 years ago. She takes tacrolimus, mycophenolate, and prednisolone for that. And she now presents with a mesenteric and small bowel mass with bowel perforation. She underwent surgery and had a biopsy taken, and it confirms a polymorphic EBV positive PTLD with a DLBCL sort of phenotype. She's had a PET scan, which shows stage 4B disease, and she has an IPI of 3. And she has no EBV DNA on peripheral blood, which can be detected. So how would you approach a case like this?
So, I mean, again, I would say this is a rather typical case of PTLD arising late after a solid organ transplant. We typically see that in solid organ renal transplants, especially, the median onset is probably 3 years or beyond. It may be slightly earlier in liver transplants. And stem cell transplants, certainly, you see PTLD happening almost always within the first 6 to 12 months. So, for a renal transplant patient, this is very, you know, typical way of presenting in many ways. The other very interesting point to note in this patient, which again I would say is very typical of PTLD, is involvement of the bowel. We don't fully understand why there is a predilection to bowel involvement, both small and large bowel, but PTLDs often do have involve bowel. As you know, there is a lot of lymphoid tissue in the bowel. And that may be one reason why there is a predilection to bowel involvement. Bowel perforation is a known side effect in some patients. Again, important to remember that bowel involvement itself should not make it stage four. So sometimes, you know, patients become are called stage four because there may be multifocal bowel involvement. That is one site of disease, though. So when you're doing your IPIs, sometimes you're caught out by, you know, miscalculating the staging of the patient if you're not doing it properly. So a patient like this would have had a staging PET scan. As you said, this patient has had a staging PET scan. I will often look at it carefully in the MDT to agree that the stage is what it has been called. Our radiologists are really well tuned into this, so they will stage it properly. But you know, you really need to work with your radiologist that you're not overstaging a patient or understaging a patient, because it will affect your IPI at the end of the day. Right? And bowel is one extranodal site. So this patient has at least one extranodal site, and you may want to know if there are more extranodal sites. Her performance status is probably impaired, given that she's had a bowel perforation, and, you know, so she may be a high IPI, as you said, at diagnosis. So we routinely will stage by PET scan. We don't routinely do bone marrows for these for staging purposes, just like diffuse large B-cell lymphoma or Hodgkin lymphoma. We stop doing them. EBV DNA load has to be measured in all patients, as you said, was done in this patient. And importantly, you have to assess EBV on the tumor, and there can be a you know, big difference between having EBV in the tumor and having EBV in the blood. Like in this patient, as you said, this patient is EBV positive tumor, and it's usually done by EBR, the EBV encoded RNA by FISH. Whereas the blood EBV was negative with this patient. We have also seen the other way around, where there is high level EBV in the blood, but the tumor is actually EBV negative, because it doesn't have to go hand in hand. It will usually go hand in hand in the stem cell transplant setting, but not in the solid organ transplant setting. So again, that I would say is very typical. We often see that. So you need your baseline assessments completed, which is very much like any other lymphoma, really, like any other diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, I would say. So ideally, you'll want a echocardiogram to assess their cardiac function. Remember, these patients often have comorbidities. They are often more unwell than your de novo diffuse large B-cell lymphomas. And you will normally start these patients with what is called the risk stratified sequential treatment strategy now, RSST, as we call it. So all patients will be considered for reduction of immune suppression. You mentioned this patient is on tacrolimus, and she's 8 years post-transplant.
She is, yeah.
So you may want to, you'll need to look at her graft function, the kidney function itself, and you will have to work with the renal transplant physicians to agree on a dose reduction of the tacrolimus. Typically, we would recommend 50% dose reduction of the cyclosporine inhibitor. And if possible, take away, if they are on additional immune suppression, you will try and take away and minimize the amount of steroid that they are receiving. Usually, most of these patients will be on 5 milligram or 10 milligram of prednisolone. That's okay. But if they are on additional immune suppression, then you may want to take it off. But these things really have to be discussed with the solid organ transplant physician. And again, you will find that for renal transplants, usually they are happier to reduce the immune suppression. Liver are a bit more conservative. If you're dealing with cardiac or lung, they will be even more conservative, because the organs are more precious, and you can't risk graft rejection in those settings, right? So with kidney, we'll usually reduce the dose, and we'll normally start off with rituximab monotherapy given weekly for 4 doses.
All right. So, I mean, in terms of prognostic scoring, we use the IPI, and I guess we do the same for many BNHLs. And that seems to be the accepted prognostic sort of scoring system for PTLD now. Is that right? Using an IPI approach?
I would say that has emerged as the most pragmatic one to use, because most people are familiar with IPI. Now, people have tried to develop PTLD-specific kind of prognostic scores. And if you look historically, a number of other factors have been described as being of prognostic importance. Things like polymorphic versus monomorphic. You can say EBV positive tumor versus EBV negative tumor, early onset tumor versus late onset tumor, bone marrow involvement, albumin. There are a number which have been described as. And if you look at univariate analysis, many of them probably were significant, but there are differences between studies when you look back. And we did a large retrospective analysis of these various risk factors as of other groups. And IPI is probably as good, if not better, than many others. And it is such a comfortable, tool for most lymphoma doctors, and even non-lymphoma hematologists are so familiar with IPI that in the absence of a, clear winner, we think that IPI is probably the most useful one to use.
So in this patient, so she goes on to have her reduction in immunosuppression, as you say, 50% reduction in her calcineurin inhibitor. She's had a mycophenolate stopped and her PRED was at a low dose. And she goes on to have rituximab monotherapy. After three lots of rituximab, she has refractory disease on an interim CT scan. So, your next option in this sort of patient would be R-CHOP because of her performance status. Although she was young, she was quite deconditioned and unwell. She went on to have R-low-dose CHOP. And you would normally plan for about six cycles in total. Is that right? I mean, with an interim, with some sort of interim assessment.
So normally it'll be, if you're giving full dose R-CHOP, all the data is based upon full dose R-CHOP, and normally it'll be four cycles of full dose R-CHOP. If you are delivering low dose R-CHOP because the patient's performance status or deconditioned, as you said, then there is, I guess, a slight difficulty because we don't know if four is enough. So I think giving six is very reasonable in the in that kind of way, especially if the patient is tolerating and if the patient is benefiting, then I would probably go to six cycles if you're using low dose. Yeah. The other important thing to remember, rituximab initial phase, it's really important that you keep a close eye on your patients because you must remember that the overall response rates to rituximab in all B-cell PTLD that you start on this treatment is around 50%. So you're expecting half of the patients will not achieve a response to rituximab monotherapy. So it's important that you keep an eye on these patients because they can progress through rituximab like this patient has done. And it's not like you see them at the beginning and then think that you will see them after they complete the four doses. They need to be kept an eye on. And the overall CR rates, I guess, are only around 25% or so. So about a quarter of patients will achieve a CR after the initial four doses of rituximab. So it's the response rates are modest. But we still use that because it helps in two ways. One is it will still avoid chemotherapy for a proportion of patients. And we think that about a third of patients will avoid chemotherapy if you start with rituximab monotherapy. And it tends to stabilize patients. If you start with upfront chemotherapy, the treatment-related mortality is much higher in patients with PTLD compared to de novo diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. So you will stabilize and hopefully, reduce the treatment-related mortality by giving an initial phase of rituximab, especially if you're achieving a response. If you're not achieving a response, then that's a difficult one.
All right, so this lady goes on to have an interim CT scan after two cycles of our low dose CHOP, and she has a 50% reduction in tumor mass. So she was planned for further four cycles, six in total. Now, I guess this brings me on to the next question, which is probably an exciting area for PTLD for some years. What happens if she were to progress? So she's, an EBV positive PTLD, in terms of cytotoxic T lymphocytes, where are we with that?
So I think we are making good progress with that, Shiver. You must remember that if patients progress on rituximab or R-CHOP, then treatment options are fairly limited for these patients. Now, a small number of patients will still be suitable for the conventional second-line higher intensity treatment regimens, like by which I mean things like R-GDPs or R-ICE type treatments. They are very poorly tolerated in PTLD patients because, even with R-CHOP, you're looking at treatment-related mortality of 10 to 15% in the context of PTLD. So if you're moving to a step further and giving higher intensity, your treatment-related mortality will escalate. And we now have EBMT data, which shows that if you try and deliver high-dose chemotherapy at a liver stem cell transplant, their treatment-related mortality is 25% plus. So, but those who survive seem to have, good disease control. The 25% treatment-related mortality is now, you know, is probably worse than allogeneic stem cell transplant in some settings, isn't it? So it is not a treatment that you will take lightly. Majority of PTLD patients are not suitable for higher intensity regimens. So if you fail R-CHOP, then treatment options are limited. But if you are EBV positive tumor, then EBV CTL therapy is certainly an attractive option. And currently in the UK, we have a trial which is open at UHB, certainly. It is called the ALLELE trial. It is basically a single-arm study. All patients with EBV-positive PTLD who have failed rituximab and are either unsuitable for R-CHOP because the proportion of patients will not be fit enough to even receive R-CHOP chemotherapy, or patients who have received R-CHOP and have failed R-CHOP therapy will be eligible for the ALLELE trial. And on the trial, they will receive third-party donor-derived EBV CTLs, which are off-the-shelf product. And they are given as, you know, cycles of treatment, generally. So if you look at data on EBV CTLs, so this is one product. This product is provided by Atara Bio. We do also have access to the Scottish National Blood Service EBV CTL Bank. So again, they are third-party donor-derived EBV CTLs. And if you look at data on EBV CTL therapy in this context, you're roughly looking at something like 50-60% response rates. And on the data we have at the moment, it's difficult to know whether CR and PR make a difference. It looks like you need to achieve a response. And if you achieve a response, then usually these responses seem to be sustained. And toxicity is minimal with EBV CTL therapy. It's outpatient-based, you know, treatment. There is none of the CRS or neurotoxicity type side effects that you expect with CAR T therapy. And the cells are usually very highly specific to EBV antigens. So you don't usually see off-target side effect of EBV CTL therapy. The problem with EBV CTLs is because they are third-party derived and they are not HLA matched. They are only partially HLA matched to the patient. So there's a significant HLA mismatch. So they do not survive for long. So they have to be given as repeated infusions, usually for these patients.
All right. So that is interesting. Sridhar, what's the turnaround time to get these CTLs? Because presumably these patients are quite unwell. So you would be working them up while they're starting, say, second line treatment with R-CHOP.
So it can be pretty quick. You know, you can, in theory, they're off the shelf. So they're there. They're really available. In theory, you could say you can get it in days. In practice, it can take a few weeks. Sometimes we are caught out with simply, you know, there are simple things like you don't have a HLA type on the patient, right? Because the patient, like you said, the patient had a renal transplant 8 years ago. The HLA type may be very basic. And if you're trying to get an EBV CTL product, we need a high resolution HLA type on the patient. And that itself can take a couple of weeks to get a result. And then you have to approach the company or the Scottish Blood Bank for access to the CTL. Funding may be required because it's not routinely funded. On the trial, of course, it is sorted for the patient. Or there is also an expanded access program provided by Atara Bio in which they will provide the cells free to the patient on a compassionate basis. But these cells are imported from US. So they have to go through MHRA import license. That can take a few days again. But typically, you will be able to deliver it. In my experience, it takes 2 to 4 weeks for most patients.
All right. So that's pretty quick then. That's pretty quick. Shall we move on to the second case? So the second case is a 58-year-old male with a renal transplant 18 years ago for polycystic kidney disease. And he presents with 5 weeks of abdominal pain. He was on azathioprine, tacrolimus, and PRED. And a PET scan shows, similarly, abdominal lymphadenopathy with small bowel involvement. A biopsy confirms monomorphic EBV negative PTLD with a DLBCL phenotype. He was sort of labeled as stage 2E disease. And in terms of his EBV load, it was negative in peripheral blood. He was started on rituximab and had 4 doses of that, but unfortunately had refractory disease, so he proceeded to R-CHOP. I guess the questions in this case, because we did touch on this a bit on the first case, he also had bowel involvement, which he said is not uncommon. But EBV negative PTLD versus EBV positive PTLD, in terms of the difference and, the efficacy of rituximab, is there anything which is different between the two diseases?
So I guess if you look at previous studies, some of the studies have considered EBV negative as a higher risk disease and EBV positive as a lower risk disease, but they don't really stand up on multivariate analysis that we have looked at. So we don't consider them as, EBV negativity itself as a risk factor for the patient. So as I said, risk factor or risk categorization is based on their IPI generally. Response to rituximab, there is nothing to suggest that one will respond better than the other. I guess early lesions may respond a bit more to rituximab than late lesions if you look at response to rituximab in stem cell transplant setting, for example. You will see around 70% responses to rituximab in the PTLD setting because they are usually EBV positive. They are usually early lesions. Yeah, so maybe in that context there is, but in the solid organ transplant setting, I don't think there is data to say it makes a difference. But it does make a difference to their treatment options if they are rituximab or R-CHOP refractory, as you said, because EBV negative tumor, they don't have access to EBV CTL, or at least there is no logic in using the EBV CTLs. So further treatment options may be limited in this context.
Yes. So this patient went on to have polatuzumab BR as a sort of a salvage treatment after not responding to R-CHOP with a view to have an autologous stem cell transplant, should they respond well enough to polatuzumab BR. A question I had is, how would you differentiate PTLD from a sort of a de novo DLBCL? Because this is 18 years on from his solid organ transplant. It is EBV negative. Is there a way of distinguishing the two?
Not necessarily no is the answer. If your patient has had a transplant, I think that is what will be used to call it a post-transplant lymphoproliferative disease. It's very difficult to know whether it is de novo or not. In the absence of EBV, especially, if it was EBV positive, then maybe you would say it's more likely to be immune deficiency associated lymphoma, which is what you're trying to ask. If it is EBV negative, is it simply a de novo tumor arising in somebody who's had a transplant a long time ago? The answer is maybe possible, but it's not. There is no way we can differentiate. So we will call it a PTLD. In some ways, you have to think, does it actually make a difference to what you're going to offer to this patient? This patient's treatment options are defined by the fact that this patient has a solid organ transplant, and the patient will be on immune suppression. The patient will have comorbidities. So their outcomes are not going to be as good as a de novo DLBCL. Their ability to tolerate second line, third line treatment is not going to be as good as a de novo DLBCL. So in some ways, it's not going to make a difference.
Okay.
Again, you can think about CAR T therapy is sometimes used for these patients. It's not licensed for PTLD setting. But if you call it a diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, in some countries, CAR T, CD19 targeting CAR T therapy has been used in the context of PTLD. It presents its own unique problems, and there are problems with the graft in the sense we can lose the graft in the context of CAR T therapy, and there seems to be excess toxicity following CAR T therapy with the limited these case reports we have seen so far, really. So it remains an open question.
Okay. So this patient unfortunately does not have a response to polatuzumab BR, and then a palliative approach was adopted. Sridhar, is there a role for radiotherapy in PTLD patients? Is there anything specific, or would you treat it as though it's sort of a de novo, BNHL or TNHL?
So I think there's definitely a role for radiotherapy and even for surgical resection. And I tend to use it, especially in the context of patients like this who have EBV negative tumor, who may have failed rituximab and R-CHOP. Sometimes you are left with just one site of FTG avid disease. And you have to consider radiotherapy and surgical options for these patients. I've had patients where there is a bowel lesion left at the end of R-CHOP, for example. It's still lighting up. It's called Duvall 5. Patient had obstructive symptoms, even bowel obstructive symptoms. Patient went for surgical resection of the bowel. It's all reactive tissue. There is no lymphoma. His symptoms are sorted. And, you know, we did not find any lymphoma, and the patient is a long-term survivor. So it's always important to remember that FDG avid residual disease may not necessarily be lymphoma. And if you have a localized treatment option like radiotherapy and surgery, you must consider it.
Okay. And is there a role for cytogenetics in PTLD? I think from what you've said, we already know what the adverse sort of factors are in these patients, and probably cytogenetics is not going to influence your management that much. Is that right?
I think that's fair to say. We do not know enough about the genetic basis at the moment. We do not know if it is, you know, radically different to diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, for example. So there's a long way for us to go to understand that side of things.
And Sridhar, just to close off, you know, what's the future of PTLD management? I imagine, you know, cellular therapies, as we spoke about, is the main thing. But do you think there's anything else, you know, that would be here in the next 10 or 20 years, which will drastically change management for this difficult to treat cohort?
I think it's fair to say a lot of progress has been made in the last decade or so. Currently, we are expecting the median survival for these patients is around 6 to 7 years, which is a significant improvement compared to what it used to be previously. A lot of the improvement, I think, is based upon rituximab, really, which has become available in the last couple of decades. A significant amount of progress is also because of the international PTLD trial led by the German PTLD groups, which have really established this risk-stratified sequential treatment strategy that we are following. In the UK, as you may know, we recruited to the TIDAL trial, which looked at adding ibrutinib to rituximab and R-CHOP. TIDAL did not meet its primary endpoint. But in the TIDAL, we do detect a signal that adding ibrutinib may avoid chemotherapy for more patients than we would with rituximab alone, for example. The trial was not designed to answer that question, so it's not possible for us to, you know, conclude that with a degree of confidence. But we definitely could see a signal that more patients may be avoiding chemotherapy by adding ibrutinib. So I guess if you're looking at future, for example, we are looking at rituximab or R-CHOP plus X type options, and that plus X can be, you know, one of the cell signaling pathway inhibitors, like we used ibrutinib, as I said, in a previous trial. It can be a antibody which is targeting a cell surface antigen. CD19 can be an attractive target on a cell surface antigen. Would we use bispecific antibodies? Because there's interesting data emerging on bispecific antibodies. Again, they may be an attractive option. As you know, they will recruit T cells to the CD20. Most of them are CD20 targeting bispecifics at the moment. So yeah, I would certainly like to think that we will be making, you know, progress. It may be slow progress, but maybe more patients will avoid chemotherapy. I guess that is the current direction of travel. We want to avoid chemotherapy for more patients because it is more toxic, a lot more toxic than it is in the de novo DLBCL setting. Cell therapy remains an open question, and EBV CTLs are available. We need better targeting CARs if you want to deliver CAR therapy in this setting.
All right. Well, thank you for your time today, Sridhar. You've given us a comprehensive guide to the workup and the management of PTLD and where we're heading in the future. Thank you for our listeners, and our next podcast will be in the next 3 to 4 months. Thank you again, Sridhar.
Thank you, Shivar. It was a pleasure talking to you today.
All right. Take care. Bye for now.
Bye.